Hi everyone, and welcome to this, the second part of the Jetstream's chat with former Newcastle Jets coach Scott Miller. I'm going to hand you straight over to Joel, who picks up the questioning around Scott Miller's departure from the club back in 2016.
After that season finished, we finished 8th, Sydney FC finished 7th from memory. We went into the next season, we had the clash against Victory in the FFA Cup in the pouring down rain, which we did lose, but Wayne Brown scored in that match from memory. David, is that correct?
Yep, dinged the keeper.
I'm just going to ask you a quick question about Wayne before we move on to the next question. You brought him out as well. He was ex-player originally through the Fulham Football Club development, and then you brought him out here. Can you talk to us about Wayne and why you brought him and how he went and how he's gone on and what you see his future holding, where you see him playing best?
Listen, I can't comment on the hierarchy of the current team or the manager's plans. However, what I will say is the football club has definitely not seen the true value in Wayne as a footballer. I think we saw it earlier in the season. I certainly saw it in the pre-season when I was there. And the type of goal you saw against Melbourne Victory is his quality. I think ultimately he's finding himself in a position now. He's been asked to play a position that is quite defensive, in that holding midfielding role, and he does have more attacking variety to his game. However, as a footballer, you're in there to play a role, and ultimately the team dictates what that role is. And ultimately, I thought he did it well when he did do it. However, his game's got a lot more. His game's got a lot more to offer. Technically, he's very good. His development is as a junior was at a high level. And he has got a winning mentality, and it's quite unique that he hasn't been as successful as I thought he would have been to this point. I hope he does get another opportunity this year. But one thing about Wayne is, if I correlate Newcastle mentality, those two go hand in hand, I believe, because he is a player that plays with passion. He plays on the edge, and he demonstrates that commitment to the point where he actually compete at a level that you don't expect him to be able to do so physically, because he is so tenacious. I hope he does get another opportunity, but it will depend on, one, the visa situation within the football club, two, the budget. I mean, we signed him on a two-year deal, and we got him at a very, very reasonable price for a visa, and the club obviously saw value in him when I left, because they extended his contract by 2 years. So they do see value there. However, it's about fit and manager's fit. And Ernie wants to play a certain way, and that's the manager's prerogative. And as I said, it's not for me to necessarily comment on the hierarchy, but certainly Wayne's got a lot more to offer. And I challenge him. I speak to Wayne occasionally, not so often, and I challenge him. I say, well, when are we going to see it? When are we going to see it? And it does come down to confidence and belief from the manager. That's no doubt about that.
He's certainly tenacious. We've seen him in not just in derbies, but in all games, and he never gives up, that's for sure. So, look, after that FFA Cup clash, we went into pre-season for the next year. The team headed to China. It was there that reportedly there was an incident that occurred that resulted in both yourself and Luciano Trani departing the club. It was reported that was based on differences relating to football matters. Can you share your side of those events and how they went down?
Yeah, you know what was great about China? One, that was the first time the club had travelled to that extent for a number of years to actually play at a level. And we played some good competition over there. And unfortunately, the feats of the players travelling 36 to 40 hours playing against a Chinese Super League team and my sacking, they didn't get the rewards they should have. We won 3 games over there, and in hard conditions, a massive amount of travel, massive amount of promotional tours against hard opposition. So I felt for them a little bit, to be fair, because they won 3 games over there, and we scored loads of goals, and we actually played some really good football. Ultimately, my job was to be sacrificed during that trip, and instincts are a really incredible thing, and I knew it. I felt it and knew it in China, and that's life. I had a sense when the ownership was going to occur, that potentially my role would not be significant there the following year, and I had to accept that. It was always my remit to fix the football club from the FFA, make it a commercially stable football club and an attractive proposition to you know, prospective owners coming in and making bids for the football club. But as for my role, it was a challenge to take at the time. As for Luch, I've had numerous phone calls regarding Luch over the last 2 years, and I've got nothing but credit for him as a coach. But it was a point of difference and respect for what we're doing here. And I must admit, it's always difficult when you join a new football club and you've got a group of players together that are really driving and really tight to break into that. And we were tight. And I must say, as a head coach and being only 34 at the time, I'm not being arrogant when I say this, but I had those players. I really had those players believing in themselves and trusting me and furthermore trusting each other. And that was the most important thing. And
I remember, Scott, sorry to interrupt, but I was speaking with some of the senior players, three of the senior players, about 3 weeks after the sacking, and they were gutted. Still, they were absolutely gutted. And as a fan and in my capacity as a sponsor, you know, we were looking to move on and look at the new season ahead. I was trying to paint some house near the stadium. And I was chatting to the guys, and Nige and Hoffman, and they were absolutely gutted that you were gone. And I just wanted to say to you that you're absolutely right in knowing that you had the team there, because they didn't want you to leave, and they were visibly, as grown men, absolutely gutted.
Yeah, it was significant. It was significant, the support from the players. I wasn't necessarily aware. I went and lay on the beach for a month or a couple of weeks at least, and sort of, reflected on it and tried to understand it. You know, when you almost see something coming, but you try and sort of sideswipe it, but you actually get killed by it. It was one of those ones. So I could see it coming, but I couldn't prevent it. So that's life. One, as a manager, and two, you know what? Strangely, as an honour it was to be a coach at 33 at the highest level in Australia, and even though it caused a lot of reflection, negative and positive, for me to go through, for some time afterwards, because it is very confronting when you do get sacked publicly like that, especially when you feel you are doing a good job within the circumstances. It can be quite confusing. However, you have to move on from that, and you have to determine and reflect upon the job you did and not worry about the things you can't control, i.e. An ownership change, i.e. an administration change, that want their own power and want their own say. And essentially, that's what it is in business and in football. But I'm better off from there. I'm certainly better off for the experience of being a head coach at that age. It's afforded me great opportunity now in business to work with Fox Sports, to know the game better at a different level, and to take something with me that no one can ever take away from me, and that is being a head coach at 33. No one can ever take that away from me. And furthermore, Newcastle offered that to me. And that's why that's significant for me.
Well, Scott, we might move on to, I think you've segued into it perfectly, that you've recently created and launched your own elite training academy for emerging football players in Mount Eliza on the Mornington Peninsula near Melbourne. It's called Identity Pro Academy. People can find the website at identitypro.com.au. Tell us about where the idea came from and fruition, and what you plan to achieve with it.
Well, I'm glad you gave it a little nod there. I appreciate that. That was nice. Long story short, it's a unique one. I was sitting in Denmark. After Newcastle, I went and moved to Denmark, which sounds strange, but it's a tremendous football country as well, very strong. And I spent 8 months there. However, something wasn't right. Something wasn't right in Denmark. Mentally, I wasn't 100% committed to it. And I started thinking further and what I can offer. And I think I can offer more than just being a head coach. I've always had this intrigue to business and strategy and structure and the psychology with building something and a team. And I set about putting this business together with some key people in Europe through colleagues that I'd worked with, you know, from sports scientists to doctors to medical staff to nutritionists, coaches and players. And I brainstormed this idea, and it's not new. I certainly can't take the credit that it's never been done before, but our aim was to do it better and improve it, but make it affordable to young players to get access to high-level IP from key people in football. From injury prevention programs to nutrition, and that's really where it started. And I got stuck into it. To be honest, I really got stuck into it. I probably spent more time on that than I did with working for Albi at the time, Aalborg. I really, really invested a lot of time into it, and it was very rewarding to see it develop. And it got to the point where my sort of mentality towards, right, what did I learn from Newcastle? Really started the emphasis of the reflection, and what came out of it was two type of books and frameworks, one for a player and one for a coach. So I've got to thank Newcastle and the experience for that, because it gave me, one, the appetite, and two, the knowledge through learned experience to put two frameworks together for the next generation of coach or player, and that's quite exciting. And it's been rewarding 12 months, because when you see something come together like that, it's quite unique. And I must admit, and thirdly, I know I'm going on a little bit about it, but I'm quite passionate about it, was I'm still a coach. And I had sort of stepped away from coaching for almost 8 months into a business sense of building this. And I missed being on the grass developing players. And I returned to Australia, and I got approached to open up an academy on the Moyne Peninsula. And I said, Leah, let's go. Let's do it. So we've got some incredible partners, and what's defining is it's an elite academy, but open to everyone, and that's important, because elitism isn't only open to certain players with certain quality. It should be open for everybody, but the elitism is the education attached to it, and that's what I'm looking to provide to the players, certainly on the Moyne Peninsula. And we've actually got a bid down here. The Team 11 bid isn't too far in Dandenong. So I was talking to them last week about affiliations and partnerships. And so it's a community-based thing. And I must say, Newcastle taught me that, taught me the community. And that's significant.
No, that's great. Look, I wanted to, a little birdie tells me you've written a book. Yeah. Tell us about the book.
Who was the birdie?
You.
Terrible. I thought it was going to be
someone. Come on, you and I chatted and... You
thought it was going to be
book,
someone but... important.
Well, I didn't want to say you'd told me you've written a book, but now that's exactly what I've said.
Yeah, well, the book is interesting, right? So it's called Winning Mentality. So it's actually two. It's actually two books, Joel. I've been busy, all right? So two books. But so one defines a player's pathway, and it's interesting. You talk about the Socceroos. And I always hear this winning mentality. We have a winning mentality. But I got back to it, and I'll repeat what I said. We haven't won a game. So what defines winning? Is it the player's behaviours, actions, or is it the outcome? But this book goes further than the actual outcome, and it becomes very individual for the players. So the brainstorming happened in Aalborg on a very snowy night, essentially, and I started brainstorming 11 key areas of what the winning mentality is and should be from my perspective. With 11 men on the field, I feel 11 is important. And it starts with the why you're here, and essentially defines the framework for the player. And it's interesting, the players that are currently undertaking the program find it very helpful when they're going through a challenging period of time, whether it be injury, setback, or lack of playing time. And why it's successful is because the players involved in it. It's not a book you read. It's a book you design by yourself with key questions. So you can almost suggest it's an online course that the player goes through.
Like so a manual.
Yeah, like a manual. But it opens up key questions regarding key areas of confidence, of leadership, of resilience, of motivation and lifestyle. So it designs a framework for the player to touch base. And they get a copy of that. So it's not a book you read and put down. You continually evolve it as you go. So it's interesting. I've enjoyed writing it. The feedback is, wow, I wish I had this when I was a young player, because I would be able to center myself when I come under challenge and stress. And that's what young players need.
And is the book available for purchase from the general public?
No, so if it's available online, so it's actually an editable PDF. So that's a very challenging word to say. If you try and say that quickly, it sounds like you want to eat the book, so forgive me. try and say that off air. It's very difficult. So, no, the structure of the book is essentially,
With James like that, you can come back anytime.
I know, it's tough, that. The dad joke, right?
You fit in perfectly.
Terrible. I'm wearing a tweed jumper as well. Can you believe it? So basically, it's an online course and workshop. So it's essentially, instead of a book, it's an online workshop that one we can work from. Because the way it's structured is it's based with a performance coach via Skype, and you get performance support. So it's not a book you read and fill out yourself. That personal contact and touch, I think it's important from someone that can support your mentality, but also guide you through it and get you questioning who you are more to design the strongest framework possible. And you can only do that with a few leading questions and support. So it's actually quite ironic. I'm working with a young Newcastle boy right now, and Christian Briamora. He was a Newcastle boy, and he's working through the framework right now. And he's gone through difficult times of late with, you know, transient lifestyle. And he sees it as a real solid foundation for him. So it's on the website, and you can contact me to call me about it. But my pathway right now is supporting Australian football from a holistic approach. And I think that's where my academy is going. We can support it differently in developing players. And what better than taking charge of it and creating your own player as opposed to waiting for someone else to do it?
That's a fantastic approach. I have to say, action speaks louder than words when it comes to these things. So look, we want to change tack a little bit here. You were with the Fulham Football Club, you know, a fabulous club that a lot of Australians hold dear. You went there in 2006 to commence your coaching career. How did you prepare and how did you gain a role with a Premier League club at this unknown young Australian bloke?
Yeah, exactly. Even more unknown. And I was really unknown when I arrived at Newcastle, so you possibly couldn't make it up. You possibly couldn't, because in 2006, you talk about internet, and let's just quantify what the internet was back then. And if you remember LinkedIn in 2006, it was non-existent. So the fact there was no LinkedIn, emails were, you know, existent but non-existent, and I literally wrote hand letters to football clubs. And I had a place to stay in London at the time, and that's about it. So my resources were very limited, but one thing I didn't care about was fear. I had no fear of going over there and attempting to break free. I look back now, right? Honestly, I look back and go, I had no right to get on that plane. Like, really, when you think about it, I had no right to get on that plane, because everyone has a right, but when you think of the outcome and how positive it was, you think, how did that happen? And I shake my head sometimes. But opportunity, an amazing guy in Steve Nance was there. He's an Australian guy. And I asked him for a cup of coffee, and I did so, and I volunteered for 6 months. I said I'd volunteer for 6 months, and that was obviously working and not being paid. And I think they paid my expenses. It's going back a long time. But within that 6 months, a staff member moved on. And I found myself within 3 months on a business class flight to Hong Kong with the biggest room alive at the Grand Hyatt for the Asia Trophy. It was scary. It really is. And interesting enough, I knew nothing. Let's be honest, right? Let's be honest. You think you know everything, but I knew nothing. In context with managing, leading, sports science, the environment, I knew nothing, but I had confidence and I had belief in myself, and it was quite astounding that Steve Nance, after 3 days being in Hong Kong, he had to go home for a family illness, and I was therefore there for another 10 days running the program myself at 26 years old, looking up to all these players who were playing in the Premier League going, wow, how did I get here? But I always felt like I belonged there, interesting enough, whether or not that's naive or not, I always felt like I belonged there, and I grabbed it and I didn't let go for 9 years.
Oh, fortune favours the brave, and I always talk in business about how infrequently people will just come to you out of the blue and hit you up. whether it's, you know, for a conversation or whether it's for an internship or a job or whatever. It happens infrequently. People should do it more often. So I applaud you for having that approach back then. So that's wonderful.
It was good fun.
You were there in 2000, so at the time that you were there, very interesting names. And just having a look at the squad at the moment, Clint Dempsey, Jimmy Bullard, Brian McBride, who's the captain. A couple of very anti Nemi. I remember him. He spent some time with Liverpool back in the day, I believe.
Yeah,
he's
a funny guy.
Funny guy. Yeah, right. Well, what were some of the highlights? Can you give us an anecdote from your time, if you can, from the 9 years you spent with Fulham?
Well, it's funny you talk of Jimmy Bullard, and it's funny how people mention him quite a lot. He is my first pre-season there, so I joined as a volunteer. And everyone, so I basically got the short straw. And Jimmy Bullard was recovering from his anterior cruciate ligament. So I was actually given him as my first player to do his end-stage rehab, all his on-field rehab, whilst everyone else was in Sardinia and Spain and Portugal on holiday. So he and I spent 6 weeks together. And there I determined that he was absolutely mad, right? Because I don't know if you know him, but in a good way, mad. Because... you can't attribute someone's unbelievable commitment to something, but then in the next moment be off the charts doing something completely different. And that was Jimmy. So he was an amazing guy to work with. And the anecdotes were obscene. Some of the banter. My first 6 months there, I wanted to fight everyone because I didn't understand the banter, because it was highly sarcastic and driven based upon sarcasm, as I said. So it was quite challenging to adapt to that. But once you get the British culture and banter, it's completely different and so funny. So once you buy into that, your environment becomes one of the best environments you'll ever work in, because one, you're working with incredible footballers, but the environment is so competitive, but so funny at the same time. So anecdotes, Jimmy Bullard was at the forefront of them. I won't divulge too many of them, but he was certainly at the forefront of them for a long period of time until he was sold to Hull. The mentalities stand out. The competitiveness in training, I've never seen anything like it, which is where I get my standards from, because these guys are fighting for positions to play in the Premier League. There's no greater honour to play in the Premier League. It's an incredible arena to play in, not only financially for these players, but worldwide exposure to challenge yourself, and that's what they're fighting for. So that's where my standards come from. But some of the laughs we've had. I mean, I remember this. You'll laugh at this story because you talk about the glorious side of football. There was an ash cloud, I think, in Iceland back in 2010 or 9 or 10. And we were due to fly on Mohammed Al-Fayed's private jet, right? And you should see this plane, phenomenal thing. We were meant to fly to Hamburg, and this eruption occurred 2 or 3 days before. And we couldn't fly. We had to drive two buses instead. And we took these two coaches to Hamburg, stopped off in France overnight. And we were probably about 50 kilometers outside of Hamburg. And we hit the autobahn and we stopped dead. A massive accident about 50 kilometers outside of Hamburg. And we all had to get off the bus to stretch your legs. And someone pulled out a football. So you've got this Premier League team about to play in the semi-final of Europa League playing head tennis over the top of two double-decker buses, 10v10. So you couldn't see the ball actually coming, but you were playing this head tennis, and all these people are out with their camera phones and all this stuff as we play head tennis over these two double-decker buses. And who would have thought the night before a semi-final in Europa League you're playing head tennis on the Autobahn in Germany? And that's what football's about, right? You can't make it up. Really, you can't. It's crazy.
Fantastic. did your team win? This is the question.
I'm just trying to think, to be fair. You know what? I've got no idea. I've got no idea whatsoever. But it was great. Great fun. It was a great fun. No, listen. No, probably not. Probably not. I had Anthony Emi on my team.
How would you describe the feeling of being in the crowd or on the sidelines as you were at Craven Cottage? It's a really boutique, small stadium. It's a very historical stadium in London. Yeah. What's it like being there?
You know what, Sam? As you said, historic. You've got Stevenage Road there. Three sides of the stands are the newer stands, but then that front facing is very old. And I used to have a motorbike, and I used to ride up in my suit with my helmet on and park right out the front, get my wash bag out underneath the seat and walk straight into the players' entrance there. So that in itself is quite unique because you can't really get that close to stadiums. And that's what I attribute to Fulham, a family community club, but accessible. An amazing place. But as you know, the tunnel starts at the bottom right-hand corner and the music starts and you walk out to that stadium. And it's only 25,000, but it's a unique place. And I get goosebumps thinking about it. It was 9 years there and incredible games. But imagine the ability to be out there, kicking the ball with the players, being active with the players and being a part of something that evolved from potential relegation to top 10 finishes. Unique. And I think that's why I felt comfortable in my role, if I'm honest with you, because the pressure I felt was always bigger in Europe. And my role was potentially bigger in Europe because of the level of player to the money involved. So I felt that I was very ready to take over Newcastle at the time and didn't feel fearful of it because I'd experienced it for 9 years at a massive, massive level.
It was only 5 or 6 weeks ago when the Cottagers beat Milo Yednak's Aston Villa 1-0 in the Championship playoff to return to the Premier League. What does that mean to the Cottagers and how do you think they'll go in the EPL this coming season?
Well, you know what, you can look at it a number of ways, and the experience of being a head coach, you learn more about the commercial and the budget component. And if we talk about it from that standpoint, firstly, you get balloon payouts from the Premier League up to 4 years outside of the Premier League, and Fulham have been outside of that for some period now. So if you consider the balloon payments, they get smaller and smaller and smaller as you leave the Premier League. Yeah. So the cash injection only to the football club, you're talking between 40 and 60 million annually now being reimbursed back into the football club from the Sky Sports rights. So you can only imagine the staff, the personnel, the infrastructure, the new stadium that can actually support, but also the transfer budget. It's no longer the chairman's cash. It's the TV revenue that can support that now. And the clubs will actually be making a potential profit because Shahid Khan took over the debt and paid off the debt. So it was running at a profit even when it was in the Championship because of the money that he invested into it. So I'm excited. I think the manager's done an incredible job. He's got the players. And do you know what? From the transition of management and the style of play, he's playing a completely different style of football. It's more proactive, more attacking. More risk, but they've certainly seen the rewards. But my fear is a couple of the players, Sessegnon, for example, there are a couple of big players in that team, very young, who are massive assets. But Fulham chief executive is very astute and he's put them on long-term contracts because the longer contract the player's on, which means the buyout clause is bigger. So they'll certainly get a return on investment, which will assist in further transfers. But I'm excited. I think I'll have to go and watch a few games because it's awesome. You go there and you get a pie, the cottage pie, and sit in the Riverside Stadium or the Riverside Stand. It's an awesome place to go and watch a game.
Oh yeah, I like the sound of that. During your time there, you did have the opportunity to work under a number of managers. Initially, you were there with Chris Coleman, I believe.
Yeah, Chris was there for the time I was sort of as a volunteer. He was there. He left in December, though, so it wasn't so long that I worked with Chris. But he's a powerful man. He's got a charisma and an aura that doesn't surprise me. He's done quite well. It didn't work out at Sunderland, but he had an incredible team down at the Wales national team, and he's a good coach, but a complete aura, if that makes sense, as a manager. A significant leader, really significant.
Other significant or notable managers, I think, during your time there were Roy Hodgson, Mark Hughes and Martin Yole. What traits, technical or personality-wise, have you adopted or even recognised you didn't want to adopt from these managers and implemented in your coaching style?
Yeah, well, they're all different. They're certainly all different. If I reflect on them now, the results were pretty consistent between the three in terms of positions that we finished the season. So you can't suggest any one of them failed. One thing notable is recruitment. I saw a complete shift in recruitment strategies. Roy was more attached to the Scandinavian robotic style and very detailed, logical type of player. And then Mark Hughes and Martin Yole were more inclined to recruit more creative players. more creative in a sense of, one, creative in the transfer market and spending a lot more money than Roy did, but also the technical and tactical attributes were completely different as well, which I felt, and a lot of people felt, unbalanced the squad slightly. And initially they made these investment into the squad and had to actually retract it slightly by supporting the more defensive structure with more defensive-minded players towards the end, because the culture changed too much. And let's face it, we were a classy club in a big league with a small budget, but we had an identity, and that was hard working. And it sort of shifted quite aggressively under Mark, and he really had to retract that to stabilise the team. So I saw players and managers really having to adapt quickly to style, but also managers respond to that very quickly as well, and really underpin what the club was about. They're all incredible men, all highly selfish in a positive way, and that's what I learnt, that a manager has to be single-minded, focused, and really your behaviour has to be consistent at all times. And I think that's why managers burn out, because your message has to be consistent, your energy has to be consistent, and you're on all the time. You are on all the time, and you're even on more so if you put pressure on yourself. And I certainly did that at Newcastle. I look back now and I put ridiculous amounts of pressure on myself, one, to succeed, but two, to build something. And I'm not too sure if it's healthy, if I'm honest with you.
Okay, well, we'll finish off with a couple more questions. There were a number of A-League jobs available in the off-season. Were any of these interest to you?
Yeah, I spoke to both of the clubs. I'll be honest with you, I spoke to both of them. It was funny working with Fox. I was really enjoying the Fox exposure to a different side of it, and I'm looking forward to that next year as well, from more of an educational standpoint as opposed to a critique. I'm looking forward to really getting invested in that. But I spoke to both Wellington and Central Coast, initial talks to. They wanted to sound out my interest in returning to coaching at the time. To be honest with you, I thought I certainly would have been able to do a positive job at both football clubs. However, I wasn't prepared at that time to invest that amount of energy into something that potentially didn't have the infrastructure or support to match the intensity in which I wanted to work. And fair play to Mark stepping into Wellington. He's got a big job in his hands, but I give a tremendous amount of credit to anyone who steps into a head coach's role, because it's not easy, and it's not easy with no money, especially in the A-League. So fair play to him.
Mm. Scott, that's really interesting. We do hope to see you one day as a coach back in the A-League or elsewhere, which is precisely my next question. What does the future hold for Scott Miller, and where do you see yourself in 10 years from now, in 2028?
Yeah, that's okay. 2028. Okay. So, you know what's interesting? What I've learned in football, I had incredible amount of stability for 9 years, and then I saw the opposite spectrum to instability, to two clubs in a year and a half, lived in three countries in a year and a half, and now found myself starting a business in Melbourne. I couldn't have planned that 2 years ago. I wanted to remain in Newcastle and be as successful as possible. Do I want to return to an A-League coaching position? Yes, I do, but only when the time's right. But you can't plan it. The A-League is all about connections. It's all about timing. And ultimately, I've learned a lot about what club I take next won't necessarily be the first club that pops up. I think I'll make a conscious decision about if it's good for my health, my family, and where I want to be. But, you know, I've got bigger aspirations than just being a head coach. I want this platform, Identity Pro, to be worldwide recognised as a pioneer to coach education and player development. That's the first thing. And I want to own an A-League club. That's it might sound crazy, but I want to own an A-League club at some point, not for monetary value, but take over an A-League club and run it with the right key personnel that I think Australia deserves, and the standards in which Australian football should be led by. And that's a long-term view. But hopefully, with the right partners, I can maximise that at some point throughout my life.
That'd well, cool. You heard it here first on the Jetstream, an exclusive. And we'd love to see you moulding and shaping an A-League club as an owner and more in the future. That's quite a scoop, David.
Absolutely, mate. Absolutely.
Yeah, listen, I've always dreamt big and gone for it. But it's not about owning it. It's about putting infrastructure in place for the players and developing coaches and backroom staff. That because I worked at all levels. I was an intern. I was an apprentice to a head coach. So I've worked at all levels, and I think that's why I've got good relationships with staff, because I've been there once upon a time, and I know when the manager doesn't listen to them, how that can affect them. So that's the future aspiration. Whether or not it eventuates in 10 years is unknown. However, you've got to look forward, right? You've got to be ambitious, and I've always been so. So I'm looking forward to the next 10 years, no doubt.
Awesome. Before we move on to the next question, can we talk a little bit about that? And, you know, because it's relevant to talk about A-League expansion. You've mentioned one of the bids already, but can you talk to us about who you think the two expansion teams would be or should be, and where you see the competition heading after that?
I think it's going to be just what the A-League needs. And going back to the Socceroos, potentially, if we'd got out of the group stage, I think that would have been an incredible injection of energy and commercial interest for the A-League. So that was unfortunate. That hasn't happened, but the October announcement of two new teams, one is going to increase, obviously, the challenge for other teams to be competitive, and they're going to have to make better decisions on player recruitment, because they're going to be two further clubs that can snap up players quicker. It's going to put bigger pressure on all teams, because ultimately there's going to be two new benchmarks as well. And what happens when you invest new money into a business, generally, they need to be competitive from the outset. That will be a decisive point from the FFA. And when I mean competitive, I mean commercially, not just playing perspective. I'm really excited by it. I'm pretty confident it will be a Melbourne and a Sydney team. I think that's pretty standard. I think Team 11's got an outstanding opportunity to take advantage of a demographic that is huge and can encompass hundreds of thousands of people if they get it right. But it comes down to the right investment. I think in terms of Sydney, my education or knowledge on their bids is quite limited. But I think the FFA really want infrastructure and support. And I think any bid that looks to the community to leave a legacy from a stadium to an academy, I think will have a massive advantage to do that. But with that comes significant investment. And who's got that amount of money at this point? I'm fearful of. Because I took over a head coach's role at a football club that supposedly had money to a degree, and I know how expensive it is to run a football club. And when I say we had money, I mean we had a license, we had a football club, and it's not cheap. It's not cheap. So let's hope whoever's involved is sustainable, and we can expand. Imagine having four new teams. It would be amazing for the league, but they have to be in the right demographic with the right support.
I'm not sure what it would do to your stats spreadsheet, Dave. You'd have a lot of holes there. Would you cope emotionally with this?
Scott spoke about stability and not venturing outside. That's kind of where I'm at with it. No, I'd have to. It would need a bit of fixing, mate. But
You've been there before.
Yeah, Gold Coast. I'm prepared.
Well, if you need a hand with an Excel spreadsheet, I love Excel spreadsheets. A little filter, little auto sum, mate. I'll be there on hand, mate. I love it.
Oh, Scott, you've seen nothing until you've seen.
Really?
Has he got colour
filters?
Arousing. It's arousing to look at, I've got to tell you.
Oh, all right. Send it through. I'll buzz off at the Excel spreadsheet.
Scott, there'll be people listening to this podcast who are aspiring coaches or may well be coaching at this current time. What advice can you share with them from what you've learned in your career so far?
Well, firstly, I ask them to connect with me personally. I'm in a different stage of my life now where, you know, as a head coach, you almost shut yourself off from the pressure, and you become a bit of a hermit because you want to disconnect. Because you're protecting, one, yourself, you're two, your privacy. But my life's different now. So any coaches that want to connect, they can connect via my website. There's no problem to build a relationship, because my experience is is bigger than I think I give it credit sometimes in terms of who I've worked with, what I've learnt. But it's so big that sometimes we all go through that and we don't self-reflect enough and respect what we've done. And with the same with you guys there in terms of what you're developing, you're putting out something that people are listening to every week, and that's a credit to you. But coaches need to believe in themselves, but also have a pathway of what can they achieve. Because I would almost suggest that being a coach is more challenging than being a player. There are more players than coaches, essentially, because there's more opportunity. But you've got to be an individual. You've got to have strong values and be committed to development. Because one thing's for sure, being a coach, you don't get any credit when the players win, and when they lose, you get hammered. So be comfortable with that, and be very comfortable with people coming for you and your job being on the line all the time. But with that, it's a very rewarding job. And they always say, who would coach? Only a coach can answer that, because the satisfaction of seeing your team sitting at a restaurant eating, building relationships and laughing and gaining trust and a team developing is nothing I've ever felt more significantly than at Newcastle. So that's my fondest memory of that, seeing that team build from scratch.
That's wonderful. Look, this is the big question, the final question. How will Newcastle Jets go in the coming 18-19 season, and can they go all the way this year?
Well, I did state, it was quite ironic, Bozza, Mark Bosnich, off air said, you're off your head. And I said, no, I'm not. I called it quite late in the season. I think it was in January. I thought Newcastle would have won the league outright and gone on to win the final as well. And obviously they didn't win the league itself, but they went very close. But that was my belief at the time. Just watching and knowing the dynamic of that group, you speak of Jason and Nigel and key players in that group and Stephen, I know their mentality, and I know how challenging the last 2 years had been for them, and they wanted to make a difference and they could smell it. So I really believe they're going to do it, both do the double. I think the fact they've got 18 or 19 players still on contract now and only need to recruit two or three players, that's significant. As a manager, he's not starting from scratch, which means continuity, which means relationships. And the challenge Ernie's got now is complacency, but he's very experienced with what he does, and he'll really get into them about complacency and going to the next level. I think they'll be in top two. I wouldn't be surprised if you see another grand final in Newcastle, and a trophy within the next 2 years in the cabinet at the head office.
We'll take it. What do you reckon, Dave? We'll take that.
Yes, I think we will.
Yeah, I believe it. I believe it. You've got a great manager there. You've got great support in terms of funding, and the community's behind you. So why not? Why not?
Wonderful. Scott, look, I have to thank you so much for giving up your time to speak with us tonight on the Jet Stream. We appreciate your openness and the wonderful stories from behind the scenes and the many phases of your career. Remind us, before you go, where can we follow your academy online and on social media?
Oh, listen, it would be great. I've just actually worked out Google Analytics, so I'll be able to tell if people click on it. So it will actually be at www.identitypro.com.au. So by all means, you can get in contact as well. So if there are any coaches out there or community members that want to get in touch, by all means, touch base, and we'll have a chat about the good old days. No problem about that at all.
And it looks like Identity Pro is on Facebook as well. Search Identity Pro, and we'll get you on Twitter before you know it, mate. I'll give you a masterclass.
I'm going very visual, and we're on Instagram and Facebook. I'm keeping it there. This Twitter stuff, no good, no good.
No, it's not. Well, listen, thanks again, and thanks to all the Jets fans for listening to another edition of the Jetstream off-season. We will be back in the next few weeks with more interviews. So please don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and leave us an iTunes rating and subscribe to the podcast if you're not already subscribed to the various podcast apps. And that's all from us tonight. Go the Jets.
Go the Jets. Oh, I'm down, Benjamin.